Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, Pecatonica Superintendent Jill Underley defeated former Brown Deer Superintendent Deb Kerr to become the top schools chief in Wisconsin. The legislative budget writing process officially kicked off this week when the Joint Finance Committee held agency briefings on Governor Tony Evers' $91 billion plan. And a nonpartisan analysis found many of the bills Republican lawmakers floated to spend incoming federal COVID relief dollars may not be allowed under current guidelines. Rewind, your week in review for April 9th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court today issued a long-anticipated ruling on voter rolls. Justices in a 5-2 ruling Friday morning found a lower court erred in ordering the Wisconsin Elections Commission to immediately purge thousands of voters identified as having potentially moved from the rolls. The majority agreed that it's up to local clerks and not the Wisconsin Elections Commission to remove the so-called movers from the list. Now, this case dates back to 2019, when the Wisconsin Elections Commission sent mailers to some 230,000 voters who had been flagged as potentially moved. And that's part of the state's participation in this national system called the Electronic Registration Information Center. At the time, the Wisconsin Elections Commission had planned to wait until after this most recent election, April 2021, to do the purge to remove those voters from the list because of errors that were or misidentified voters in the last round of purges. But the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty in a lawsuit argued the removal should have happened within 30 days of the mailers being sent out. WC data shows that while 230,000 voters were initially identified as movers, the list is now down to around 70,000, none of whom voted in the 2020 presidential election. In the ruling, Conservative Justice Brian Hagedorn and fellow Conservative Chief Justice Pat Rogensack sided with the court's three liberals to issue the majority opinion. Anything stand out to you in this ruling, JR?
One, that Hagedorn's decision is pretty clear-cut, that it is the local officials who are responsible to maintain the rolls. And in his wording, there's no reasonable argument otherwise. Now, Conservative Justice Rebecca Riley took issue with that. She believes that reading the state law in whole suggests that the commission has a responsibility to help, or a role at least, in maintain the voter rolls. Also, she noted that the commission has before participated in cleaning up these rolls. There's a kind of an interesting subtext here. Remember, when the Ozaukee County judge first issued this ruling that the commission must immediately, essentially, clean up the rolls, the commission deadlocked 3-3 on whether to actually go forward with that because they were going to appeal that ruling and said, hey, we don't know for sure it's going to stand. Well, when they didn't move forward, Will went back to that Ozaukee County judge and sought a contempt order, essentially, and he issued fines to the commission and the three Democratic appointees in that body for not basically doing what he said, told them to do. The appeals court put that on hold, eventually overturned it. The majority opinion today affirms overturning that contempt order. It's interesting is Bradley also takes a big shot at the majority for doing this because she says that it undermines the basically rule of law in Wisconsin. If you have an actor, a state agency, who doesn't immediately respond to a court's order, what's that say for other people who are ordered to do stuff? Say, well, I don't have to do it because I'm going to appeal this, so I can just kind of wait. So a little bit of a kind of lower level drama there in the decision, but for most part, it's pretty straightforward. Now the question is going forward, okay, how are locals going to clean up these rolls, and what's the commission going to have to do in light of this decision to kind of help them do this? Because other thing is, there was a little bit of you mentioned the 71,000 who they haven't found yet, who did not vote in November. The other kind of aspect of this decision is that it did play a role in the complaints that Donald Trump supporters had about the 2020 election. They tried to sow doubts about the results, and because these voters weren't removed, there was a problem. This kind of, you know, the finding that there were the 7,000 did not vote kind of helps tamp down that complaint. Also worth noting that there are about 17,000 voters who did not move, were identified by Eric as possibly having moved, that if they had gone through this, you know, removing of the rolls, they would have been pulled off even though they hadn't moved and would have re-registered a vote in November.
Right, and this does have implications for the use of ERIC and Wisconsin's participation in ERIC going forward. If it is up, you know, to locals to administer this process, that means, I suppose, that in big elections in 2022, we won't see a process beforehand, before the November election, for example, of a removal of thousands of voters from the rolls that were flagged by other government databases as having potentially moved. So that's one thing to watch for going forward, exactly as you said, JR, is how will this be administered at the local level and when?
Yeah, well, Will, in his reaction to the decision, said he's disappointed that it doesn't have a great message for requiring agencies to follow the law. The group suggested the legislature needs to go ahead and fix this. Now, we have a state legislature right now that's involved in all kinds of election law changes it wants to make, at least Republicans want to make, and there is about zero chance of agreement between Republican lawmakers and Democratic Governor Tony Evers on those changes. I don't know the chances of a fix to this issue getting through amidst all the other stuff they're talking about. I mean, yeah, there can be a legitimate question about how this should be administered, if they should clean up the law, but there's just not really a working relation between the Republican legislature and Democratic Governor Tony Evers to get something like this done in the near term.
That's right. Moving on to state election results this week, Jill Underley won the race for state superintendent of public instruction. Jill Underley, a Pecatonica superintendent, was backed by Democrats and the state's teachers union, the Wisconsin Education Association Council. She won 58% of the vote over former Brown Deer superintendent Deb Kerr, according to unofficial returns. That was the only statewide race on the ballot on Tuesday. Turnout was around 20% statewide. Now, down ballot in other election results, we saw Republicans win in the 13th Senate District and the 89th Assembly District, both open seats. In the 13th, Representative John Jagler beat Melissa Winker to succeed now Congressman Scott Fitzgerald in the seat. In the 89th, Elijah Banky is joining the legislature, and he succeeds former Representative John Nygren, who retired back in December. In the Court of Appeals races, we also saw conservatives win the two contested races. Shelley Grogan beat out Judge Jeff Davis, an Evers appointee, in the 2nd District. And in the 3rd District, Gregory Gill won. With Underley's win, Democrats have won 10 of the last 11 contested statewide races in the past 4.5 years. The exception, of course, being spring 2019, when conservative now Justice Brian Hagedorn won that election, surprising many people. JR, do Democrats see this latest victory as evidence that they have momentum heading into 2022?
Well, they're going to sell it as such, but let's kind of back up for a second. DPI races are not great indicators of what's going to happen the following year. It just like spring races in general aren't great indicators of the following year what's going to happen. 2019, Brian Hagedorn won. In 2020, Joe Biden won. You know, things like that happen. It's a different electorate in April than it is in November. So there's that. Number two, the DPI race is a unique beast unto itself in Wisconsin politics, because for as long as I've been up here, the candidate that had the backing of the state's teachers unions basically was won this race, had a flawless record winning this race. You also see Democrats are much more interested in this campaign than Republicans are. You've seen it before where Democratic groups get much more involved than Republican ones do. It's the same story year after year where Republicans kind of go, okay, maybe we have a shot this year if we do A, B, and C, but they only go out kind of a half-hearted effort into trying to actually win the race. So it's a different kind of contest. So yes, it'd be great for Democrats. They're on a roll in Wisconsin in terms of winning elections, but does this mean that 2022 is going to be a Dem year in Wisconsin? No, don't read that into like what's going to happen in 18 months after what happened this past Tuesday.
Some of the down ballot results too really did stick out to me. Even though conservatives, you know, obviously lost at the DPI level, they added some judges. They made inroads into local school boards and local governments in general. I think I saw the WIS Red group, that conservative group, as well as Rebecca Clavish's PAC. Rebecca Pack, their backed slates of candidates won, you know, a few dozen races. Also, sort of in the local election side of things, I was looking at referenda results from schools, and we saw 60%, or I think 42 of 70, were approved, which is a little bit lower than we saw in recent years, where approval rates were around 80 to 90%. So that's sort of an interesting thing I'm keeping an eye on. Jared, what dimension do those down ballot results add to sort of your assessment of the election?
Well, in the appeals court races, you had conservatives winning conservative districts. So that's not really a surprise. A little bit of an interesting thing that Shelley Grogan, the second district, beat Jeff Davis by a fairly healthy margin. Davis ran an interesting campaign. It was a more of a traditional judicial campaign where you tout your endorsements and your support and your qualifications, which that's always to talk about Supreme Court races years ago and appeals court races. Well, now Shelley Grogan ran a clearly partisan race where she appeared with Republican activists and elected officials and ran as a Republican. The reality is those races have always been partisan. They just kind of were under the surface. It's more of an open embrace of that partisan approach, and it worked because it's a conservative district in the 2nd District Court of Appeals. One thing that really stuck out to me was looking at those legislative elections and the special elections. You know, it wasn't a surprise that Jagler and Behnke won. What I was watching was the margins, and that's because Donald Trump won the 13th Senate District by 20 points in November. Jagger won like about 7.5. Now, caveat there was a guy named Spencer Zimmerman who was a perennial, and I mean perennial, candidate in special elections for legislature. He runs, even if it's not like the district he lives in, and it often is not, he's still on the ballot. Well, he ran as a quote-unquote Trump conservative on the ballot Tuesday. He got 4.5 points. Okay, even add that to Jagger's number, and he's still not at the 20-point win that Trump had in November. Likewise, I think Trump won Behnke's district like by 30 points. Behnke won by like 24, 25, something like that. What I'm getting at is, are there any signs in these elections that the Trump voter is disengaged a little bit in Wisconsin, or dispirited, that the Republican base is not really engaged right now because of a hangover effect from November? Now, it's anecdotal evidence so far. These are special elections. You got to be cautious reading too much into it. That said, I heard stories of Republicans on the doors where they'd get voters saying, well, you know, Dominion voting systems runs the election anyway. They're going to flip votes for Democrats. Or what's it matter? What's it matter if I vote? It doesn't matter. It's all rigged anyway. And again, anecdotal, small sample size. But when you're talking a 50-50 state like Wisconsin, if that discontent in the Republican base continues until November of next year, every little bit, you know, helps or hurts. So if you got a couple, 3 points Republican base feeling like it doesn't matter or I'm not engaged, you know, that's not great for Republicans. Again, small sample size. November 22 is 18 months away, but just keep an eye on that. Does the base get back engaged for Republicans, or is this hangover continue after what they saw in November of 2020?
Right, and at the DPI level, I think there's a question of whether, you know, Deb Kerr was trying to run as still identifying as a Democrat who didn't support President Trump, but still trying to vie for conservative votes. So there was a question of whether she was able to, and you know, obviously it turns out she wasn't able to effectively do that, but that's another dynamic that sort of came into play on Tuesday.
Yeah, we often talk in politics about like candidates having a lane. You know, like Jill Unruly ran as a pro-public school, pro-union candidate, like, and she stuck in that lane. There's no two questions about who she was, who she was backed by. She was running as a Democrat, essentially. Kerr, though, started out trying to be all things, all people, like some people tell me, you know, trying to say, I'm a Democrat, I voted for Joe Biden, but I'm also going to run on supporting voucher schools, and I want to get kids back into school in person learning now. Kind of like appealing to like a conservative segment of the population, as well as frustrated parents whose kids aren't in school. And as the race went on, you saw her get a little more conservative. Like a week ago, in the last forum before the election, she embraced efforts to ban transgender girls from participating in sports with what she said biological girls. And this was a debate last week. It seemed like she was moving farther right as the race went along. And when you don't really have a lane that you stick to, like you're not a clear, this is who I am, sometimes it's hard to get people on your side. These spring races, the lesson might be from this and that Court of Appeals race in the 2nd District that you'll run as a pure partisan. Make it clear who you are. That ignites your base. And in low turnout races, because even though it's 20%, which is not bad for a spring election, it's still 20%. That's not a huge turnout in Wisconsin. You're talking mostly partisans turning out. Ignite your base. Get them excited. And that might be a better ticket for you to win.
Moving on to more DPI-related news, Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin questioned the state's top K-12 education official, State Superintendent Carolyn Stanford Taylor, on reopening schools and federal aid in the first agency briefing of the budget process this week. Republican leaders of the Joint Finance Committee lamented how federal relief dollars were appropriated to schools over the past three COVID relief packages. That comes after the co-chairs released a Legislative Fiscal Bureau memo showing that Milwaukee Public Schools will get over one-third of the $2.2 billion slated for Wisconsin districts from those packages. That's because most of the money is distributed through the Title I formula, 90% of it, which is based on the number of low-income students enrolled in each district. In the past, Republicans have sought to prioritize dollars for districts providing in-person instruction. It remains unclear how the federal money will factor into the way Republicans approach the K-12 budget. The Department of Public Instruction and Carolyn Stanford Taylor, as well as Democrats, repeatedly cautioned that these are one-time federal funds and more state support is needed in this budget. Jared, did we get any clues from Republican lawmakers this week on how they plan to craft the budget while taking the federal money into account?
There are options that they have. The trouble is for Republicans, those options give Governor Evers fodder to use his partial veto authority. Remember, Governor Evers, as all Wisconsin governors, have one of the strongest veto pens in the country. He can rewrite bills to his liking if they spend money. The thing is, the more language you put into a bill, the more fodder you have for Evers to rewrite it. And again, it only applies to spending bills, not just normal legislation. But let's say, for example, the Republicans wanted to create a new categorical aid for schools that had in-person instruction. And it says explicitly, this aid is for districts that had in-person instruction in 2021 school year. All Evers would have to do is cross out the word in-person, and it would go to everybody, right? So that's an example of like how that pen works. So as they look at ways to try and factor in the federal money and reward, in their minds, districts who are in person, the question is, how can you do that without tempting Evers or giving him that fodder to make it something you don't want it to be? Same thing goes for local aids for municipalities and counties, because we're seeing Milwaukee, for example, getting big pots of money from the federal government. How might that affect the debate over shared revenue, which is state aid to local governments? You know, something to watch. But you can tell there's already a theme developing among Republicans in the Joint Finance Committee of rural Wisconsin versus Madison, Milwaukee, and they're feeling that their districts are getting the short end of the stick with all this federal money, because it's often based on these formulas about poverty. And remember, the money that Milwaukee Public Schools is getting, it's the same formula under what Joe Biden signed as Donald Trump signed. It's a bigger pot of money, but it's the same formula. It's no different than it was before. So it's not like this is a change. It's just that the numbers are getting to be quite big and starting to get a little bit of blowback from Republicans about what's happening with this federal money.
Sure. Let me get your take, though, on a tweet that we saw from Republican Speaker Robin Voss this week following Underley's win in the DPI race. He said, quote, "Count me as someone who isn't going to support putting another nickel into this unaccountable state bureaucracy." Do you have any sense of what that means? Are you reading into it much as we're heading into this budget process?
Well, there was a follow-up tweet from Robin also that he's not looking to defund schools. He's talking about the bureaucracy. And so there's a difference there about, you know, the DPI administration, about, you know, adding positions or that kind of stuff. So that's clear that he's talking about that. I don't know he's talking about, like, cutting school funding for public schools or anything like that. That not seem to be what he's talking about. It's more about that, again, the administration. Still, what are Republicans going to do with state aid to schools when they're seeing all this federal money flowing to, again, I hate to keep saying bringing Milwaukee up, but Milwaukee is getting a third of the money. I mean, that's $800 million out of $2.2 billion over the three packages. That's where most of the money is going. Madison does okay on this as well. Racine, Green Bay, they're the bigger districts that have the higher poverty levels. That's why they do so well.
Now let's hear from State Superintendent Carolyn Stanford Taylor and members of the Joint Finance Committee during Tuesday's agency briefing.
Since submission of my recommendations, the federal government has appropriated $2.4 billion to K-12 schools in Wisconsin. The receipt of these funds does not change the recommendations I made last fall to address the ongoing needs of schools.
I'm not advocating for any cuts, but I do believe that we should and can use existing money state money to recognize that some school districts have, under that formula, fared a lot better than other districts that were actually open. And on a one-time basis, I really encourage this committee to look at ways that we could be more equitable in the dispersion of that money. And I would welcome for your department to be part of that process.
So, yes, while we are grateful for those dollars, there were some issues that would not have been present in our schools and communities had we not been in COVID. And the impact of COVID on those students will continue beyond the next few years. And that's my plea to you, is that we look, we forecast out, and recognize the continuing needs of our districts.
I mean, when I look through the budget requests here, I see Milwaukee, I see larger districts specifically named. And yet I watch our small rural schools burning up their funds on transportation. So I do hope, as we are looking forward, that there's a little bit more focus on outside of urban areas, and that other parts of the state have their challenges also. Thank you.
But I think what the number one issue is, if you really do talk to the school administrators and the school districts, it's the special needs funding in this, which is why what the governor is proposing is so important, because it's going to allow our schools to do so much more under the revenue limits that they have to live with.
Republican lawmakers' plans to spend federal COVID relief dollars may not be allowed under current guidelines. The Joint Finance Committee this week approved 11 bills along party lines to spend much of the $3.2 billion Wisconsin is getting under the American Rescue Plan Act. But a legislative fiscal bureau memo found that proposals to pay down state debt, create grants for local highways, fund emergency communications, and more may not be allowed under the current federal guidelines. Now, the U.S. Department of Treasury could provide more guidance to clarify which proposals are allowed, but it's important to remember that the legislature currently has no say in how the dollars are spent. Still, supporters say the effort would ensure the money is spent wisely and with extra oversight. EVRA spokeswoman Britt Cutaback said in a tweet, quote, "It is no surprise Republicans are too busy playing politics to worry about jeopardizing federal funds that will help our state bounce back from this pandemic." Jar, you talked last week about how these bills were put together pretty hastily. Is this LFB analysis here more evidence of the rushed process here?
A little bit, but remember, too, big picture, they're not going to become law because governors are not going to sign these things. So it's kind of an academic exercise, ignore over these bills with these LFB analysis. Now, a couple things to note. Like, for example, the property tax provision that Republicans want to do. So they want to take about $1.1 billion of the money and do essentially a 10% tax rebate to homeowners. The LFB analysis said that this appears to be an allowable expense right now under what the federal government set down. But without further guidance, they can't, like, give final sign-off on it. Now, in talking to Republicans, I mean, they're like look, we wrote these bills with the help of the Fiscal Bureau, so these all should be okay. But Devin Lemieux, Senate Majority Leader, in his testimony to the Finance Committee about these bills, called the LFB analysis basically speculation at this point. But the bottom line is, this is all about trying to put a message in front of voters about Republican priorities, also maybe get Democrats to take some tough votes, and then try and get Governor Evers to veto some things that may look popular politically. But let's be honest, I mean, like the $1.1 billion for a property tax refund, the more expensive your home is, the bigger refund you're going to get. That's not really how Democrats like to spend, do tax breaks, right? The ones that benefit those who are wealthier. So that's not going to become law. Again, it's a messaging thing, trying to put something out there to counter the governor's message, because the governor has sole authority to spend this money. Republicans want to put markers down of this is how we're going to do it. And these bills have gone from being circulated late Thursday of a holiday weekend last week to assembly committees on Tuesday for public hearings, assembly committee votes on Wednesday, joint finance hearings and votes on Wednesday, now the assembly floor on Tuesday for final votes to get them out of that house. So it is definitely a quick process, not unheard of. I've seen it before. But again, it's more about of a message than it's about getting something done.
Let's hear now from Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux and Senator John Urbanbach during Wednesday's joint finance committee hearing on this subject.
Without a defined plan for Wisconsin on how the federal money will be spent, how can we ask your committee to provide a responsible budget if we don't know where all this federal funds are going.
Do you have any comment on, it appears that maybe 9 of the 11 proposals you either may not be able to do or might not be able to do based on federal guidelines?
There is no federal guidance yet from the federal government. And, you know, I did see the memos that were put out by the Fiscal Bureau. And I believe those are just based on speculation at this point.
Because there's no guidance, we might not be able to do 9 of the 11 proposals that you have here.
We think once the guidance comes out that these are very important things to invest in, and we hope that the guidance covers it, and we can continue to adjust as this guidance comes out, but we feel these are vitally important for Wisconsin.
If the money could go out sooner to where it needs to be, are you in favor of that, or would you rather do it through the legislative process, which we know is going to take a little while?
You know, I think we'll get a better product if we go through the legislative process. So if it takes an extra week or two, I think we can take that time to make sure we're spending the money most wisely.
With all due respect, it's going to take a lot longer than a week or two. We're talking months.
We have some mixed COVID-19 news this week. On one hand, Wisconsin recorded the highest number of new COVID-19 cases in 2 months on Thursday. Also, the state's 7-day average of cases was twice as high as 1 month ago at 733 compared to 390. On the other hand, though, officials began vaccinating all Wisconsinites 16 and up on Monday, and over one-third of Wisconsinites have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. Meanwhile, in Madison, the COVID-19 mass vaccination site received FEMA support on Wednesday, increasing the number of vaccinations per week by 1,400 doses. Another community-based vaccination clinic is set to open on April 13th in Douglas County. The recent surge in new cases is driven by COVID-19 variants and infections among children. Let's hear now from Dr. Ryan Westergaard and DHS Deputy Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke on this.
Compared to a month ago, our 7-day average is 100% higher, 100%, a doubling. It was 380 the week of March 10th. It is now, as you said, over 700. So this is a real trend. We are in a new phase of the epidemic that is clearly worse than we were before. And it's transmission among young people who are driving the change in the curve.
We are not ready to go back to life pre-COVID. Right? We continue to, as you've heard both of us say, when we are together, we need to continue to wear masks. We need to continue to social distance. We are not ready for huge mass gatherings yet. And we need to be cautious as we move forward. I want to be really clear that there may not be a statewide mask mandate anymore, but that doesn't decrease one iota the need for everybody to behave as if there is a state mask mandate. The worst thing in the world we can do right now is say no mandate, no mask, because we are, as has been said here, seeing spread of variants, and we need to use the mechanisms we have in place to prevent spread. So Dr. Westergaard, what would you add to that?
I'm very uncomfortable with the idea of loosening anything, with the exception of the guidance we've received from CDC about limited indoor gatherings among fully vaccinated people and households. I don't think we should be changing anything.
On to stock picks. What's rising this week, JR?
Ben Wickler, state party chair for the Democrats in Wisconsin. Look, education is a priority for Democrats. Number one. Number two, Tony Evers used to be state superintendent. This is an important race for them. That's part of the reason why they put $1 million basically into Jill Inouye's campaign. Don't forget, though, the benefit for Wickler, who's going to run for re-election state party chair later on this year. Maybe he has higher ambitions than being state party chair within the national party apparatus. It's easier to make the case to keep investing in Wisconsin to donors if you keep winning. 2022 is going to be much bigger deal than 2021 with a governor's race and Senate contest and the ballot. Winning now helps Wickler make the case, the continued case, for donors to keep open their wallets for Wisconsin's Democratic Party.
And mixed?
Derek Van Orden, a Republican, is back for round two versus Ron Kind, even though we don't know the lines of that district yet. Look, Van Orden getting in now helps scare off other Republicans from a primary. You'll see the NRCC, other Republican groups, get behind him and give him money. The issue, though, is we don't know what that district's going to look like. until after the new lines are drawn. And that might not be until sometime a year from now. So until you see those lines, hard to get excited about this race because we don't know what the confines are going to be. If the seat stays the same or gets better for Democrats, Kind's probably in good shape. If it gets worse for Democrats, helps Orton, Ben Orton. Two, we don't know if the Trump voter will turn up without Trump on the ballot, and the Trump voter helped make the third much more competitive than it had been in the off year, so that's another factor for Ben Orton to worry about.
And falling.
School choice advocates. Look, you know, when Tony Evers was state superintendent, they had somebody who was almost like agnostic about the program, right? Jill Underley is more antagonistic. She ran saying that she wants to basically do away with it and thinks that it's competing for dollars with the public school system. That's not right. A state superintendent can't just like do away with the choice program on his or her own. What they can do, though, is put up bureaucratic hurdles that make life more difficult. This is another example where we hear Republicans every 4 years say we should have done more in the DPI race, or there's an opening there, and just not being able to find the right combination to win. And this is one of the impacts. You have somebody now, the choice program that most Republicans back, is not going to be a friendly hand for them going forward.
Thanks, JR, and thanks for tuning in this week. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm JR Ross.
And that's Rewind for April 9th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.